that effort. So today, we're going to, as we've been doing, we sort of focus on an idea or an issue or a tool, and then we look at a case study of someone who's exercised that tool and done it in a remarkable way. So today we're looking at Eleanor Roosevelt and a creative introvert. And this is a pretty extraordinary story of a woman who was extremely introverted. Very, very shy, very uncomfortable person who became maybe the most outstanding woman leader of the 20th century. Whoa, dude, how does that happen? You go from being someone who doesn't want to be around other people, wants to just be alone all the time, to someone who becomes a world leader. How does that happen? And I think I want us to focus on what are the tools that she used, what made her make that transition. Many of the people in your Twitter card response last time were saying they'd like to move toward the extroverted end of it. That's exactly what Eleanor Roosevelt did. So let's figure this out. What was it that was stimulating her to do this, and how did she accomplish it? So very interesting story of this woman. She was a gangly, self-conscious child who lost both her parents by the age of 9. So she would have been certainly a baby who was intrinsically introverted. But then imagine losing both your parents before you're 9 years old. And that certainly threw her a curveball and made it even more difficult for her. Her patrician mother, Anna Hall Roosevelt, was a doyenne in high society in New York. She was very beautiful. She was very gracious. She was wealthy. She was highly successful. She had 2 sons and a daughter. And unfortunately, she looked at Eleanor as kind of a mistake. Lovely and sociable as her mother was, Anna had maintained a distance from Eleanor, emotionally disowning her only daughter for her plainness. She was very disappointed that little Eleanor was not an attractive child. She was plain. And in her mother's world, being beautiful was really important for a woman. And she was really distraught about the fact that she'd had this girl child who was not as attractive as she wanted her to be. "You have no looks," she informed the little girl, "so see to it that you have some manners." So she embedded in Eleanor from an early age that she was inferior, something she couldn't control, her looks, you know, but she saw her child as inferior. She was very affectionate toward her 2 sons, but she was cold and critical toward Eleanor. She nicknamed her Granny, and she told visitors, "She's such a funny child, so old-fashioned." Eleanor says later, "I was always disgracing my mother." And it was very, very painful to her. On the other hand, she loved her father. And she was very devoted to her father, and her father reciprocated fully. Eliot was warm and expressive. He clearly adored his daughter, but he had a very volatile personality. He was very exuberant and outgoing, but he was a troubled man. He was also brother to Teddy Roosevelt, who, of course, became president. So Eliot Roosevelt was alcoholic. He was addicted to morphine. He was suicidal, attempted suicide many times. He was very violent, and he had a sexual addiction. He lurched from mistress to mistress, and he was even sued by one of his servants for paternity. He was an embarrassment to the family. He was very much an embarrassment to his wife, was this socialite lady. and she had this completely out of control, crazy ass husband. The family's desperation became kind of a scandal. And there was a headline in the New York Herald, one of the big newspapers there, that proclaimed, "Eliot Roosevelt, demented by excesses, wrecked by liquor and folly, is now confined to an asylum for the insane near Paris." So at a certain point, the family just got sick to death of this disgraceful behavior, and they carted him off to Paris, where he would be as invisible as possible, and put him in an institution for the mentally ill. That was, of course, extremely distressing to Eleanor. She later wrote that as a child, she acquired a strange and garbled idea of the troubles which were going on around me. Something was wrong with my father, but from her point of view, nothing could be wrong with him. She worshiped her father. And yet, you know, he's troubled, and then finally he gets sent away. Eleanor's happiest moments as a kid were spent alone at her Aunt Bi's house. There was a little maid sewing room that Aunt Bi would let her commandeer, and there she could go, and no one bothered me. She could just read, she could have her own fantasy world, she could be completely alone, which is what she liked the best. Her mother died of diphtheria when she was 8 years old. And she was taken in by her maternal grandmother, Miss Mary Ludlow Hall. The Halls were a very wealthy family in New York, and her grandmother was a socialite as well. And so it wasn't a big transition there from wealthy, lots of servants, lots of family pressure that just transferred to the Hall family instead of the Roosevelt family. She got letters from her father. She loved getting the letters. She lived for them. And infrequently, she got a visit from him. But basically, she was a part of the Hall household. And she was shuttled back and forth between their Manhattan house, big luxurious townhome there, to the country home on the Hudson River near Tivoli, New York. So that was what her childhood was after age 8. After a period of drunken, violent upheaval, her father died a year after her mother when she was 9 years old. And of course, that was crushing, crushing for Eleanor. Bereaved, lonely, and painfully shy, the only comfort that Eleanor found was in her books and in music and in nature and this rich fantasy world. So already at this point, she's mining her introversion to create a fantasy world, to create imagination, to let her life inside her head take over, because the life outside her head was horrible, and terrible things were happening out in that world. But she retreated into her own head, her own imagination, and lived a kind of fantasy life there. This is classic creativity, that notion of being able to just wallow in your own imagination and thought. And even as a little girl, that's where she's going. And this is a real plus of introverts, that ability to just have a very active life inside their head, where they can imagine and they can fantasize and they can think things that other people aren't thinking. So by temperament, she was very clearly an introvert. But growing up in a socially prominent house, she had to develop a kind of public persona. There was no choice. She was trotted out when visitors came to the house, and she had to be gracious, she had to be polite, she had to have good manners, she had to speak up. She couldn't be this mumbly, quiet little kid. She was forced to have a more extroverted personality. Social life was very important in my grandmother's world, Eleanor would later write. And her social code demanded a great deal of self-discipline, particularly of women. So it was not a choice. A woman in her social status was expected to be out there at parties, participating in the social scene in New York, very demanding social scene. And she just had to discipline herself to get through those things. So she did it, and she could do it, but it was extremely uncomfortable for her. Eleanor would credit this stern code of behavior for getting her through a myriad difficult occasions later in life. Okay, so this is a tough situation. The question here is, how does she move from introvert to extrovert? How does she increase her number, as we were talking about in the Twitter card? And one of the ways is she's freaking being forced to do it. And it's super uncomfortable. She does not want to go to those parties. She does not want to be the belle of the ball. She doesn't want to be the focus of attention. She doesn't want to be introduced to these important visitors to the family when they're trotting out the kids. She doesn't want to do any of that, but she's forced to do it. And that is an important step. And she says, you know, it got her through a lot later in life. If she hadn't been subjected to that, she couldn't have done what she did later in life. So one big question I wanted to talk about here is, what about that uncomfortable push to be more extroverted? Is that a good thing? In this class, we require everybody to do a pechkucha. You have to stand up in front of your discussion group, and you have to give a presentation on your project. And I've had students come to me and say, please, let me do anything. I don't like to do public speaking. This is uncomfortable for me. I'll do any other kind of extra credit assignment, but I don't want to have to stand up and do a pechkucha. And you know what I say to students in that instance? No, you have to do it. I know it's uncomfortable. I know it's maybe miserable, maybe really, really painful for you. But it's good for you. It's something you need to be able to do. In the case of Eleanor Roosevelt, there were many, many of these instances where she was extremely uncomfortable. This was not something she wanted to do. She was forced to do that. But in the end, it was good. So, I don't know. This is something to think about. Those uncomfortable moments, the ones where you just don't want to do it, are those, in fact, really important things to just tough it out, bull through, take it, and learn how to go forward. I'm not going to have the discussion on that, but I want you to be thinking in your head, oh my God, is that something I'm open to? These painful, hard, forced interactions. So Eleanor's grandmother decided to send her to England in 1899 to attend Marie Souvestre's school for young women, the Allensworth School. And that was a move that transformed the 15-year-old girl's life. So this was a finishing school, is what these were called. So that it was partly about education, but it was very much about learning social graces. And in that period of time, social graces might well have been interpreted extrovert behavior, because it was all about being able to, you know, be the hostess, be the leader in a way of conversation and discussion. And the Brits were really good at this, and they didn't just assume that a kid was going to learn that growing up in a household. No, you went to school and you learned how to be a good conversationalist, be a host or a hostess at a party. These were social graces that you had to learn. And her grandmother felt like she was deficient in that regard, hauled her ass off to England and signed her up for Marie Souvestre's school. Now, that turned out to be a fantastic thing. Young Eleanor found a glowing inspiration and mentor in Mademoiselle Silvestre. She was a woman that Eleanor considered intellectually emancipated, and she flourished under her care at the school. Now, there may be three or four things that are going on here. One is she's taken into an environment where it's all women, so she doesn't have to deal with men. And there probably were some gender issues here. Her father, her mother, her grandmother, her, you know, some complicated things she was dealing with in terms of her own gender role and so on. And maybe a safer environment being in an all-girls school. Even today, we have in Austin Independent School District, we have an all-girls high school. And that is meant to be a safer place for some people to really learn the kind of skills we're talking about here and leadership skills in a different kind of environment. But also, this was very much a mentorship environment where Mademoiselle Silvestre was, she took her under her wing and she helped her personally. Intellect, sensitivity, kindness, and nobility of soul were cherished at Allensworth because Mademoiselle Silvestre loved and esteemed Eleanor more and more the other girls did too. So here was, it was not only a mentor relationship, let me help you figure out how to do this, but also I respect you, I love you, I care about you, and then other people saw that. And because her mentor was a leader and someone other people respected, they transferred that respect to Eleanor, and that gave her some confidence. So I want to have a little bit of discussion here about this maybe one way to move to a more extroverted personality is to find a mentor or find a helper or find someone else who could help convey that. And I want to have a little discussion here about what is the value of being forced. What is the value of being motivated? What is the value of being in a safe place, like the Allensworth School? What is the value of a mentor, someone who can help you get through this? What do you think about that? So there are a whole lot of people who said, I want to move from a 5 to a 7. Can you imagine a scenario of how that might happen via maybe being in a safer environment to exercise these kinds of characteristics, or maybe having a mentor? Anybody have any experience in that, or imagine a scenario in that regard? So I'll give a few personal. I mean, I was very much an introvert. As a kid. And I had a father who was extremely extroverted. And everybody was, my dad was a popular guy. Everybody loved my dad. All my friends thought I had the coolest dad around. And my dad was kind of disappointed that I wasn't more outgoing, and especially when I was a little kid. And he forced me to do things. I can remember in high school, the one thing I could do was public speaking, because if I could prepare it all in my head and then just be a performer, that was easier than, you know, more informal interaction. So I had done this speech and I won this speech contest, and my dad was like so proud of the fact that I'd done this extroverted kind of thing. I'd won this speech contest. But then he, like, my parents were really social people. They had a lot of friends over to dinner. And so they were having a dinner party one time with a bunch of friends in the house. And he I'm in my bedroom, retreated back there, and he wants me to come out and give my speech to his friends. Holy shit. I still, to this day, that was horrible. That was so incredibly painful. If I'm standing up in an auditorium with a bunch of strangers and some judges, I'm fine with that. But these are my parents' friends, and I'm supposed to stand up there pretending I'm giving a speech to an audience, and it's in our freaking living room, and, you know, I'm comfortable. I'm back in my bedroom by myself. You know, don't make me go out there and do this to your friends. But he did not give me a choice. Get your ass out there and give that speech. And I did. You know, all these years later, I can still feel that wound of how painful that was. But I don't know. Maybe that was a really good thing my dad did. Kind of cruel, but at the same time, he wanted me to have those skills that he had found so beneficial to him. He was a businessman, super successful businessman, and it was his extroverted personality that helped him enormously in business. And he saw this shy kid, and he thought, dude, you got to fix this. And he was going to force me to fix it. I don't know. Anybody else got a comment on that? Yeah. So, you know, these are questions, whether you put yourself in these painful positions, whether you resist these painful positions. Do you throw a hissy fit and tell your dad, I am not going out there? Or do you just suck it up and do it? What do you think, Michelangelo?
So, I actually have an example where I was forced into a situation, and then following that came motivation, and then following that came actually a mentor. So I was getting into high school, so I was a ninth grader. I was in an English class, and we were forced to, or we were reading Shakespeare at the time, so we were reading Romeo and Juliet, all this old text. We had to like read when we were reading the book. We had to play parts. And I never really wanted to stand out. I was more like just kind of blending with the crowd, be cool, like don't be noticeable. And my teacher was like, you know, Michelangelo, I need you to read for Romeo. I'm like, fine, whatever. And so I read it, and I was like doing like a lot of emotion and like a lot of this stuff. And at the end of the class, the teacher was like, you know, you should be in theater. And I'm like, no, theater is weird. I'm not gonna be in theater. And she's like, no, you really should. And it got me thinking for a while. And I got really motivated, and I did some research, and I was so motivated that I went to someone in the office, my counselor, and I was like, listen, I want you to get me into a theater class. I don't care if I have to wake up at 7:30 in the morning. I'll come in, I'll take this theater class. Didn't end up working out, but fortunately there was a guy who was in my neighborhood who lived like a block away from me who was an actor for a long time. And for 8 weeks, he agreed to come over to my house. We like learned acting, taught me everything. And when I came to, this was in California, and when I came to Austin, I did theater for sophomore to senior year of high school. So definitely I'm really happy that I was forced into that situation, because it's gotten me to where I am now. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Exactly. And those, that transferred into life skills, not just theater skills, that it makes you comfortable in a lot of other situations. So, yeah, I think these kind of intentional experiences, or maybe not resisting uncomfortable situations, those might be a real key to developing this. So the Halls, her mother's family, Eleanor realized had taken very little interest in public affairs. But at Allensworth, Eleanor soon began to engage in the world in heated discussions of politics, social issues, and arts. So there was suddenly a new content at Allensworth. Her family was just about a kind of narcissistic, social life, self-importance of this elite in New York, but they really weren't interested in larger issues of the world. And this was a new thing to her, to think that, yeah, you could talk about politics, you could talk about art, and social issues, and she was interested in those. In 1901, while she's off at school in England, and she's 16 years old, her uncle Teddy Roosevelt becomes president of the United States. And she was one of his favorite nieces. He was very, very fond of Eleanor. His brother would have been the jackass who, you know, was a drunk and, you know, did very irresponsible father for Eleanor. Teddy felt like he needed to kind of stand in and make up for the deficiencies of his brother. So Teddy was very fond of Eleanor. And now suddenly Uncle Teddy is president of the United States. Eleanor returned to New York. And one thing Madame Silvestre had emphasized in her school. So when she came back to New York, she immediately looked for opportunities to get involved in public service. And she started teaching children on the Lower East Side. This was immigrant communities at that point. And she started investigating sweatshops and women's working conditions for the Consumers League. So she began to get involved in social issues in New York. And this is a 17-year-old girl. And this is something her family's not interested in. Doesn't want her to be doing this, but she takes on those causes. At about that time, she also begins to get involved with Franklin Roosevelt, which was her fifth cousin once removed. They'd known each other when they were little kids. In fact, there were photographs of a little baby Eleanor riding on the back of three or four-year-old Franklin. But they'd only seen each other occasionally, intermittently, through their teenage years. But now back in New York, they met at Madison Square Garden in 1902 and then quickly became really good friends. They were cousins and enjoyed each other's company. They seemed like polar opposites. He was this urbane, self-assured extroverted kind of guy. He was very handsome. She was very plain. She was serious, and they were just kind of opposite human beings. But they enjoyed each other's company, and he especially appreciated her intellect. She was smart, and he also enjoyed her interest in social causes. Both of them shared those interests. And then, surprise to everyone, they got married in 1905. She was 21, and he was 23. People thought that Franklin really married below his standards because he was handsome and he was socially adept, and he was popular, and Eleanor was quiet and kind of off the radar screen, and people couldn't figure out why Franklin would want to marry Eleanor. But in the end, they got married, and it was complicated from the beginning because Franklin was this very spoiled only child. His mother, Sarah, doted on him, and they moved into the house with Sarah. So there, again, it's another wealthy family, and they move into the house at Hyde Park, which was a big mansion. But man, it's like there are three people in this marriage because her mother-in-law, Sarah, was there all the time. So as a way of escaping Sarah, she wanted to build a little cottage at Fallkill, which was a little stream a ways away from the big house, but on the property. And she built this very modest little house there. She asked Franklin, I can't live in the big house with your mom all the time. I need a house of my own. So this very, very modest little house that became her real home. And she had women friends at Allen's, where she'd come to really value women friends. So she cultivated women friends there, and she would have them over, and they would discuss art and music and books, and they'd have picnics, and they talk. And she had these very good, close set of friends, just a few women that she was buddies with. And she thought the peace there was divine. And so she's living this kind of hermit life away from the social swirl and away from her mother-in-law. It's a very strange arrangement of their marriage, but she has her own tiny little cottage, very modest, away from the main house. So she found very satisfying work in this period. She ended up having 5 kids with Franklin. And she was raising a family that was very demanding. She has 4 boys and 1 girl, and they're kind of, you know, year and a half, 2 years apart, bang, 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 through this period from 1921 to 1927. She started these little entrepreneurial things. She, of course, had her own money because she'd inherited her mother's money and her father's money. So independent of Franklin, she was a wealthy woman. And she wanted to invest that money in something that she thought would make a difference. So she went to Appalachia in West Virginia, and she realized that there were craftsmen there who knew how to make furniture, old traditional furniture that had been done for generations in that part of the country. So abundant wood there. These were just people who learned father to son, you know, how to make this furniture. And yet at that time, because there was beginning to be manufactured furniture and these handcrafted furniture pieces were kind of priced out of the marketplace. So she went to West Virginia and she started a company that produced reproduction furniture that was handcrafted and put these people back to work who had been put out of a job by industrialization. And then sold it as premium kind of furniture because it was more handcrafted. And she found a market for that. So she was a kind of savvy businesswoman, but it was really her social purpose that led her there. She also, because she had enjoyed Allenswood so much, she thought, you know, you shouldn't have to send your kid to England to get this kind of education. So she started a girls' school as well. And she taught at that girls' school in this period also. So she's got her interest, she's got her values, things that she thinks are important, and they're driving her in this period between 1921 and 27, but in a very quiet way. Now, Franklin, meantime, is having this meteoric rise in his career. So he becomes a congressman representing New York in Congress in Washington. He becomes Secretary of the Navy, a very important appointed position in Washington. He's being looked at as a possibility for governor of New York. He's, you know, he's on the rise. But then in 1927, horrible thing happens. He contracts polio, and he's stricken with it, and it's devastating. He's paralyzed from the waist down. And so all of their life is completely discombobulated by his polio. And so he lays out of politics for a while, but actually before he was fully recovered, the Democratic Party came to him and said, we want to put you up for governor of New York. And he was hesitant at first, but then he ran for governor and was elected governor of New York in 1928. And Eleanor began her life as a first lady. Now, again, this is not something she asked for. It's not something she was interested in at all. The role of a first lady of New York, governor's wife, it's a social role. Oh, my God, this is what she hates, is the social role. So you have to be the hostess at parties. You have to have dignitaries come. You have to be gracious. You have to carry on conversations with strangers. You know, all the things she doesn't like, that's her job now because she married Franklin and, you know, she's kind of forced into that situation. She was First Lady of New York for 4 years, and then he ran for president and she ended up being First Lady of the United States for 12 years, the longest serving First Lady in the history of the United States. Now, again, this is a matter of being forced into a situation she did not ask for, being pressured into doing something she did not feel comfortable doing. But she married this guy, and she's in this role. And she also realizes that in this role, there's some potential for me to do what I believe in. So she kind of redefined what the potential role of first ladies could be. And she had these values that had in part come from this period when she was at Mademoiselle Silvestre's school. But she had developed these things she cared about, and they were things like political issues, civil rights, and this is, it's amazing how prescient this woman was. She's dealing with civil rights in an era way before. So even the term civil rights didn't really exist, but she's interested in especially African Americans' rights long before the country is ready to deal with that. She's interested in women's rights, again, way before her time on that, and she's interested in human rights. So she says, okay, there are some things I care about. This job description does not really include those. No first lady has ever really taken on political causes. And that was true. We'd had all these first ladies of the United States. Never, ever, ever had they had their own political agenda. That was not the role. They were supposed to smile and be pretty and have a nice table set and entertain guests and be interested in clothes and decoration of the White House, and but this was a whole different thing for a first lady to be interested in these other things. So she starts out with a completely different agenda as a first lady, and she starts writing this column, which she calls My Day. It was begun at the end of 1935. She became first lady in 1932. And at the invitation of United Features Syndicate, she wrote a column 6 days a week, I think, and it reached tens of thousands of readers. Now, this is Eleanor Roosevelt. This is real creativity. This is freaking amazing creativity, where she's taking a job here that this is not a part of that job at all. What can I do with this job? And she's taking her own skills, which I am not good at public speaking. I'm not good at even being a hostess at a party. But what I am good at is thinking inside my head. And I'm good at writing. all by myself in my room writing. So she takes those skills as an introvert and she says, how can I use them in a role that is normally thought to be for an extrovert? So she starts this column, and this column covers all kinds of issues. She was very serious about her column. She had a huge admiration for journalism and the power of newspapers in particular in that era. So she was under contract for 500 word pieces, 6 days a week, and she took great pains to meet all those deadlines. 500 words for each piece, 6 days a week, relentlessly, from 1935 until she died. And this is a huge, huge assignment she took on for herself. And what she really talked about was my day. But it was, in part, a little gossipy thing about what it's like to live in the White House and all the important people that go through. And that people enjoyed hearing about that. That was kind of the candy for it. But she used it as a way of promoting and talking about causes she believed in. And there were a whole list of causes that she was inspired by. Because she'd done this furniture company and she'd gone to these rural areas of West Virginia and she'd seen people losing their jobs and living in poverty and not able to support their families. She got very interested in rural arts. How can we use the arts? Furniture making, quilting, painting. How can some of these people be put back to work through rural arts? Got very interested in housing, the substandard housing that was there. This is the middle of the Depression. My aunt, my great aunt and uncle, through the Depression, lived in a chicken coop because that's the only housing they could afford. They had two sons, and they lived for 5 years during the Depression in what had been a chicken coop. That was the way the Depression was, and she was really, really empathetic with these people and the issues of housing. She was very interested in country life. People are focused on cities, but she thought these people in the country have been forgotten, and they're suffering the worst as their economic problems in the country, and there's no backup for them. Her husband passed this WPA, Work Project Administration law, where federal money was used to put people back to work in construction, and a lot of times they were building libraries. She got very interested in initiating these libraries, especially in rural communities. She was very interested in public health, vaccinations, for poor people. Somehow, her upbringing, although it was a privileged upbringing, she was the underdog. She was the outcast. And she knew what it was like to be the underdog or the outcast. And she had this great empathy for people who were underprivileged. She started community centers for Negroes, which didn't exist. There were community centers for all these immigrant communities, Italians and Irish and Polish. They were coming into New York, and they had these community centers in the big cities. But what about these people that have been here for generations, but there's never been any kind of assets like that for them, where you could have classes and have education and training? And we need to have that for African Americans in our communities. She got very interested in flood control, again, largely a rural issue, where people's houses had been washed away by floods. She was a big advocate for an 8-hour workday for nurses who were heavily overworked. Again, a women's issue. She's very interested in women as a underprivileged class in the workforce. Safety campaigns for construction, for industrial jobs. How can you make those jobs safer so there's less injury? White and black cooperation, education. So in this little My Day article, she's talking about, we had a lovely dinner at the White House last night, and we used the china that was the china that the Lincolns had bought and was a part of their legacy in the White House, and it's lovely blue and blah, 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 blah. But then also the topic of conversation we were discussing at dinner was really rural housing and how can we promote rural housing, and these are the statistics and these are the, you know, challenges. And she's bringing in political issues and mixing them with the kind of social issues. They were all sugar-coated with accounts of the dinners for the Supreme Court justices and cabinet receptions, which delighted the hearts of people who would have scorned her social views if they were presented by a solemn social worker. She was able to portray herself as this, you know, this extrovert in a way, you know, kind of this outgoing, pleasant person, and then sliding in all these social issues alongside that. Her top priority in both her writing and her politics was to include those who'd been on the outside looking in American prosperity. African Americans, women, children. Perhaps having grown up as an outsider, she was especially sensitive to the injustices of living, of leaving so many people out of the American dream. Okay, so this is, if one critical thing in moving her from introverted behavior to extroverted behavior was that kind of forcing and mentoring that happened in her youth, one of the things I think that moved her and motivated her to go from introversion to extroversion was values. She had these things she believed in, and she figured out that I'm not going to be able to accomplish these with my native introverted self. I'm going to have to figure out a way to get myself out there more because I care about these issues. She was passionate about these issues, and she knew it. She felt it in her bones from her own experience of being an outsider, and that was really what was motivating her to take on a different kind of personality. As I said, she was one of the real pioneers in civil rights, the rights of African Americans with top priority in her agenda. This was not popular in the 1930s. She boldly compared racism and segregation to fascism. So this was Mussolini and Hitler were growing in Europe, and she compared the kind of oppression of African Americans to the kind of attitudes of the fascist in Europe. Whoa, that provoked a wild outcry against her. But she was fearless, and she took that on. In 1945, she joined the board of the of directors of the NAACP. This is phenomenal. This is a white lady in the White House who is the first lady. And she's out there with this radical organization that's trying to change American values. And she goes on the board of the NAACP. And she acts as a kind of intermediary between them and the Justice Department, often conferring with NAACP counsel Thurgood Marshall. Eventually, she got her husband to appoint Thurgood Marshall to the Supreme Court of the United States. But it was her involvement with Thurgood Marshall, and he became the first African-American on the Supreme Court. But she's very, very involved in the roots of the civil rights movement, really long before the 1960s when it began to really have a peak. She felt all civil rights in the North as well as the South depended on integrated housing. And she was a big advocate of public housing becoming integrated. That was extremely unpopular, especially in the South, but in the North as well. And she was a big advocate. She helped lay the groundwork for civil rights legislation of the 1960s. She had a very big influence on LBJ, who became one of its most significant advocates. LBJ was a huge fan of her husband, Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt was something of a mentor to LBJ, and LBJ became close to Eleanor, and Eleanor got his ear. She identified him as an up-and-coming young guy who was going to have a big future, and I want to be influential on this guy. And because he's from the South, he has the ability to support civil rights and be effective in a way that a northerner would not be able to. And he got it about civil rights. So she was kind of his mentor on civil rights issues. And all the way through to the time he was president, she was very much on his back on civil rights. She pushed him and pushed him and pushed him. She also was this huge advocate for women's rights. She fought both in the U.S. and abroad, and she was especially interested in these horrible, oppressive cultures where women were held down. Her Uncle Teddy had been an influential advocate for women's suffrage, the right to vote, while he was president, and she was in her 20s, so she had a kind of pedigree there. She worked with the League of Women Voters and made connections with other women activists and found a whole range of meaningful issues on women's rights. She became an advocate for equal pay, equal political representation, and was very, very involved in international women's rights, issues that we're still dealing with today of countries where women are way, way, way less than equal. More than any other first lady before or since, she used her voice to shape public opinion and public policy in the United States. Now, you know, we talked about Michelle Obama earlier. I think Eleanor Roosevelt was the blueprint that Michelle Obama tried to follow. But, you know, honestly, Michelle Obama didn't have nearly the impact as a first lady that Eleanor Roosevelt did. She was a great first lady, and she had her causes. But Eleanor Roosevelt, partly because of this continuing commentary in the newspaper, but she began to then make speeches, have a bully pulpit for advocating for the things she believed in, and she had an enormous political role. In April of 1945, FDR dies. So she's no longer First Lady. She's 61 years old at this point. And it could have been a time where she just retires from public life and retreats back to being the introvert, goes back to Valkill, and gives up all of this. But at that point, she was far from relinquishing her position of influence. She was hooked, and she continued to be a very influential force. During the first couple of months after her husband's death, she settled all of his affairs. She gave the big house at Hyde Park to the federal government, and it became the first presidential library. She bought out the Valkill and the acreage around it and kept that for herself. She moved to Valkill. She got rid of all the fancy clothes. She got rid of all the accoutrements, the china sets. She didn't care anything about any of that stuff anymore. She made a very simple life for herself. She reduced her expenses, and she actually financed her very modest lifestyle completely on the earnings from her writings and her speaking. And that wasn't because she had plenty of money. She could have just lived on the fat of the land, but she gave herself the discipline of, I'm just going to live on my income from writing and speaking, and I'm going to go out there and be an advocate for these causes. And that's what she started to do after she stopped being First Lady. There was a week hiatus at her husband's death, but after that she went on with her column, and she continued to do so 6 days a week until she died. And she continued to be a primary spokesperson for these things she believed in American culture. Now, this is, to me, just kind of the height of creativity in many different ways. She's parlaying this life inside her head, this sense of who she was and what she believed in, and then she's finding very creative ways to find an outlet that let her be an introvert but still have her voice out there, and then enabling herself to be more of an extrovert and play an even more influential role in that regard. All of that in the context that would not have been promising from the beginning. It's not who she was or what one might have expected from her. After she stopped being First Lady, she continued to write to Harry Truman, the new president, every week, He encouraged her to write to him, and she was on his back about all the causes that she'd been promoting through her husband's presidency. And Truman always responded in these handwritten letters back to her. For one thing, he needed her political support. She was powerful politically, especially in the Democratic Party. He was going to have to run for election. And he realized, I have to have her support. So she was powerful politically in getting Harry Truman to do the things that she wanted. The president asked if she would agree to be a delegate to the first organizational meeting of the United Nations General Assembly in London in 1945. This was a big deal at the end of World War II. One thing that Franklin Roosevelt wanted to do was start the United Nations. And that was kind of in sketch form and in outline when he died. Harry Truman took that on as a major project for his administration. And then when they actually got the group of countries together to start talking about the United Nations, to write a charter, to imagine what the scope of it would be, he appoints Eleanor Roosevelt to be in that delegation from the United States. I think there were five members of the delegation from the United States. Wow, that was a little intimidating to her because she'd never held an appointed position or an elected position. She had just been kind of on her own, doing her thing. But now this was an official appointed position. And it was big news. She knew that her husband had placed a lot of importance on this, and she felt a great sense of responsibility about the United Nations, but she's ill-equipped. I mean, she's not a diplomat, and international relations were really not one of her major causes that she supported. But she decided to accept, even though with fear and trembling. The delegation was a stellar lineup from all over the world, the most important leaders from all over the world. But it was, in a funny way, Eleanor who captured the headlines. Her appointment made front page news in the New York Times. And then when one person in Congress voted against her ratification, that again made front page news in the New York Times. Number one, it's a woman. She's the only woman. I mean, this is a man's world of diplomacy here. So she's completely groundbreaking in that regard. She's this woman who made her own bully pulpit. She made her own influence. It wasn't that she was an elected official or anything like that. But she became quite a focus in that group. She wasn't just a member of the group. She became really a leader in that group immediately because she was a well-known figure and people looked to her. So her major agenda for the 7 years that she worked with the formation of the UN was that the United Nations needed to take on issues of human rights. Now, that was by no means inevitable that the United Nations would do that. The United Nations could have just been a peacekeeping operation to try to keep the world out of wars. And that was really what FDR had in mind. But she thought, no, the United Nations should be an advocate for human rights all over the world. Oppressive governments, oppressive societies, the United Nations should lobby with them, should put political pressure on them to increase their attention to human rights. So there was an economic and social council that was formulated to pursue this, and she was elected the chair of that. And there was a commission on human rights, and she was the chair of that commission. There were 18 delegates from all over the world, but it was her prestige that was one of the great assets, and that was one of the reasons why they selected her to lead the group, because she had visibility. And it was really her job to say, yes, a major agenda of the United Nations is going to be human rights. And they began to work on this Universal Declaration of Human Rights that would be in the Charter of the United Nations. So for 2.5 years, she had her work cut out for her to take these 18 people from all over the world and to then have a declaration of what are the standards of human rights that the United Nations is going to stand behind and is going to insist that all member nations follow those human rights. She said that I used to think I'd reached the limits of my patience bringing up 5 children, but she quipped, I was mistaken. It took much more patience to preside over the Commission on Human Rights. There were 30 different articles in that. You know, still today, like the immigrants from Guatemala and Nicaragua, when they come to the American border, and, you know, if some people in our government had their way, you'd just say freaking no. You'd just say no to everyone. But we are a member of the United Nations, and the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights says that if people are political refugees from another country, you are obliged, as a part of human rights, to evaluate whether they are fleeing from inhumane conditions, and you're obliged to accept them if they are truly suffering from human rights violations in their native country. And that's why all the refugees from Syria going to Europe, to Italy, to Germany, places like that, you know, it wasn't like that was a choice. Those countries were obliged by their membership in the United Nations to take refugees. That's what Eleanor Roosevelt wrote in the Declaration for Human Rights. That was built into the United Nations from the beginning. And we wouldn't be dealing with those issues today if it were not for Eleanor Roosevelt's advocacy way back then. And it was many, many different kinds of things. You know, public hearings, justice, women's rights, political persecution, freedom to travel and freedom of movement, to leave their countries and to return, freedom of thought and conscience and religion. All of these kinds of things are built into that Declaration of Human Rights. Rights about especially women's rights, about marriage, and about choosing to found a family. There are things about education, rights to work, equal pay, remuneration for that, access to medical services. Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a really almost miraculous document written way, way, way back then. And nations of vastly different traditions have had to comply with that through the years. And it's made a huge difference in world politics. So here is this shy, gangly, awkward woman as a child who transformed herself to become a center of the planet's moral conscience and to really outline what it is to be a civilized race on the planet. And in many ways, she pursued just the right combination of vision and practicality to establish this human rights idea on a firm foundation. In the process, she became a world politician, indeed a world leader. For many, many years, when they would do a poll of the most respected woman in the world, for more than 2 decades, Eleanor Roosevelt was the top of that poll. She had enormous respect all over the world. And in fact, what she really became in the end was the woman leader of the 20th century. Now, how does a shy, homely young woman who does not want to be in the spotlight become probably the greatest world leader as a woman in the 20th century? Inspiring story. Okay, so Twitter card question.